Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to Behind the Curtain. I'm WGN-TV's Paul Listick. Today, we're looking at a moment back in history as it's being viewed today. You may or may not be familiar with it. It was the Columbian Exposition of 1893, the 1893 Chicago Columbian Exposition. I have personally been fascinated with that event for many, many years now. I actually have a collection. I've got books and items from the exhibition. It was really quite the big deal back then, but it still is today because you can actually see remnants of that event here. Joining me is Michael Finney, a full spectrum content producer. We'll talk about what that means, but he has essentially working with music and audio and video and photography and writing has developed some really interesting and new resources about the Columbian Exposition from 1893. He's got plans for the future. We're going to explore all of that. Michael, welcome to the podcast. Appreciate your time.
Hey there, Paul. Thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking about the project.
So for people who, you know, don't know anything about the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition, just give us a really brief history and what it was and why people should care about it. Why should we think about it today?
Well, if you're a Chicagoland resident, this fair is kind of the turning point in Chicago's history after the Chicago Fire, right? So there are four stars on the flag, on the Chicago flag, and the Columbian Exposition is one of them. The other two before the exposition are Fort Dearborn, the Chicago Fire of 1871, and then the World's Fair of 1933, which followed up the World's Fair in 1893. So it has a strong legacy. It is, culturally important, not only to Chicago, but the world in general. There are a lot of things that connect back to the event commercially and industrially, but locally, architecture, has been a huge component of Chicago's history, and there are still buildings standing in the city that are connected with the event.
In fact, actually, for folks who live here, might be listening to us in their car for all I know as they're driving by, what is it that we pass perhaps on Lakeshore Drive that we go, that's from the Columbian Exposition of 1893?
Well, the one that is right next to the Lakeshore Drive is the Field Museum. And while the Field Museum itself was not built for the exposition, its collection, the founding collection, is from the exposition of 1893, right? So when they built that building, that collection of materials that were left over from the manufacturers and different attractions and things were moved north in the city to the Field Museum from what is today the Museum of Science and Industry, right? What was then called the Art Palace. Speaking of art, right, also the Art Institute building was built for the exposition. So that was created as a meeting place, right? So a lot of committees and different collections of people were staging discussions at that building, and then it was converted over to the Art Institute after the exposition closed.
And sadly, by the way, one of the reasons, because somebody might say, if this was such a big deal, why aren't all the buildings from those days still around? But the truth is, this wasn't built to be a permanent exhibition, right? The buildings were not meant to be permanent.
That's true, right? So actually, in terms of on the grounds in Jackson Park, only the Art Palace was built to last beyond the time of the expo, right? And the reason why that is connected to fire hazards, actually, which ended up kind of destroying a lot of the other structures that were still there for a few years after the event. Now, the reason why the Art Palace was built, as a permanent structure is because a lot of the countries that were sending their art to Chicago for the event wanted to make sure that it was within a well-protected environment. They didn't want their artworks, their treasured works of history to be damaged by any sort of weather or, as it turns out, fire the potential for fire damage in a city that not even just a little over 20 years prior had been leveled because of fire was something that people were concerned with. So they wanted to make sure that they could protect that.
So, as I mentioned, I myself have a lot of collectibles from the exhibition, a clock, even a spittoon, all the various things that they actually sold back there. I guess people like to buy spittoons back there, and some vases, different things that I have. But really, I have an extensive collection of books, which include the photography of pictures from the exhibition. I have a couple of original photographs of the exhibition and an 11-volume set of all the artworks that were present there. I don't know why I got so into this, but I mentioned all of that because you yourself came across books regarding photographs of the exhibition, and that's what got your appetite whet as well.
Right. Yeah. So in the tail end of 2018, I started to publish a long-form Twitter thread. It was the 125th anniversary of the event, so I decided over the last 125 days of the year that I would publish 125 photos from a collection of official photos of the fair called The Dream City. I'm not sure if you have that book, but it's a fairly large print document. I think there are about 300-plus images in there, including some of the art that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But what was really interesting to me was not only the pictures, but some of the captions and details that were kind of laying out why and details of cost and size and everything. So what I did is every single day I would post a photo and write a little blurb on there. And day after day I was doing that. And about 2/3 of the way I was like, you know what? I'm kind of getting a lot of content here. I think that I can turn this into more than just a Twitter thread. And as I was going along, I started to save it up and put it into a document where I would begin to edit and realize, you know what, this could probably be a book. I think a lot of people fantasize about writing books. So for me, it was an opportunity to explore that and to give it a try. And that's what I did. I edited through all of that material and released a book that was a lot of those photographs. And then also some of my own photography from today's world that basically shows some of the structures and the artwork that's still standing around the city to connect the event with the world that we live in today, the city as it stands now. And that was a great fun project for me to do. I learned a lot. And as I was putting that book together, I said to myself, you know what, this could probably be a documentary. So that's what I did too. I have produced all this stuff on my own for the most part. I've had some musical contributions for the documentary, which was fantastic because there were just some great musicians that have given me access to their music to include. And it really, I think, kind of shaped out some of the emotional moments in the documentary. I feel like perhaps even their music is better than some of the music that I contributed to it.
And by the way, the book itself is available on Amazon. The documentary can be viewed on Amazon. I think it's only like $2.99 if you want to watch the documentary. Here's one thing. So in my collection, I have a couple of what have been described as original photographs. And my understanding is, and I'm drawing a blank on the guy's name, I want to say Charles Wilson, that may not be it. But back then, apparently, there was only a certain guy, let's call him Charles Wilson. And he was given the rights, because this is Chicago, to take the photographs of that exhibit. Many of the original ones are in the Union League Club. They're missing a couple of them. I've got them. And apparently, if other people wanted to take pictures or photographs, I should say, they needed his permission.
Well, I think that
all of that is not important anymore.
Well, okay, so there's Charles Dudley Arnold, who was the official photographer of the 1893 World's Fair. And his stuff was used in a lot of the promotional documents that were sent around to, garner interest for the event. Now,
right.
When you were inside...
That might be the name I'm thinking. I knew it was a Charles. I had the wrong last name.
That's okay. Yeah, there's a lot of names associated with the fair. It's hard to remember them
right.
All the time. So what you have at that event is that you could rent a camera on the grounds, right? And it was like, I think $2 to rent a camera, or you could bring in your own camera, mm-hmm. but I think they still charge you if you wanted to bring in your camera, because they were really trying to control, the media messaging about the event and how it was presented into the public, because they wanted people to experience the things that they wanted to highlight. And it worked for them. You know, there aren't a lot of kind of public photos that aren't related to Charles Arnold and, you know, the official collections of photographs. But at the same time, those official collections are really, really good. And he was very extensively photographing so much of that event that there's just great views of so much of the White City.
So when you, as you gathered the both your Twitter feed, and I should tell our listeners, that's actually how I found you. I saw your Twitter feed about all this, and it intrigued me. But for your book or your work, did you have to deal with any legal rights or anything like that, or is all this public domain at this point?
This is all public domain at this point. You know, the rights have elapsed on this stuff, and that's basically you know, one of the attractive aspects of using this topic, is that I'm not under any restrictions about this stuff. You know, there are no rights reserved for this content at this point.
So you gathered the photos, the things you're using. Did you use, what kind of standard did you use to do it? I mean, to me, listen, every time I see a book I don't have, I just buy it, because everything is, you know, so different and so unique. So how did you decide what was going to make it? I guess the Twitter feed might have been a little easier for you, but what was going to make it into the book you put together, where you had to be a little more critical about what you were going to select?
Right. So I would say probably 90% of what was in that Twitter feed in terms of photography made it into the book. Maybe even more of that ended up into the documentary. There are obviously more pieces of imagery that are in the documentary, because I started to collect more books and other print materials that had illustrations as well as, you know, the photographs. So there are different angles, and there are some moments where things switch over from illustration to photograph. And that kind of, I think, gives a nice look, and obviously, you know, there are limited views of this thing, and there's no real video of this event, even though, you know, video camera technology, well, I don't want to say video, but like moving picture technology had been developed at that point. As far as I know, there isn't any film of this event, moving picture film of the event that I've found. There have been some recreations.
I've never seen it.
Right. Oh, man. Wouldn't it be fantastic?
Right. Well, we just need to get, you know, Eric Larson to write a new book. Devil in the White City. Maybe we'll get some of the video when that movie comes out.
Right.
And out of curiosity, who is your audience? For folks who look at the book, are there people like me who are just fascinated by the World's Fair? Do you want students to take a look at this? Teachers who are teaching it? Do you have a audience in mind for who will get the most out of the book or the documentary?
Well, you know, the thing is, after doing this for the last 2.5 years, I've really found that many, many different types of people are interested in this, and they're kind of coming at it from so many different angles. Like, there are people that are involved with antiques that I connect with. There are other authors that I connect with, other, you know, people looking to document things historically and artistically, trying to think of other aspects of this. There are people that are interested in architecture, and I'm connecting with those folks. There are people that are just focused on the educational aspects, because they see that many things tie back to the event, as I've found too. So I think that, you know, there's so many different beachheads of culture for people to become aware of and familiar and interested with the event. You can pick anyone you like.
And so this is a labor of love, something you are so into, you share with us, but something like this probably has no end to it, because there's always the next step, the next move. What's next in this? I know you're trying to go for some grants right now. Where do you see this heading in the years to come?
Well, now that I've been advancing all of these different aspects, I started the social media components last year in the summer as I was getting ready to release the documentary. I think that there are good opportunities to kind of roll back. I would like to release a second edition of the book. I think that I've learned a lot more, and there's more stuff to put in there. And then there's also some errors to correct as well in terms of typos. So I have to fix that up. I would love to work with a publisher or maybe a media company that can help with distribution or packaging. I think it would be fantastic to be able to put the documentary and the book together and offer it as some kind of component that is for students or for education or just people that really love this event and this history. I would love to work with any of the museums around the city to basically facilitate the expansion of the content or the integration of the content that I have into their projects. And I know that there are a number of things that are going on or have gone on in the last 10 years regarding, this topic. So those are, relationships that I'm reaching out to begin and expand and see how, everything would overlap and fit together. What I do intend
to do... And I'm curious... Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. No, yeah. What were you saying?
No, go ahead. Go on.
Sure.
Well, I was going to say, I can see the connection between the World's Fair and moving on to other events. For example, one of my prized possessions, but an original copy of Daniel Burnham's 1909 Plan for Chicago, which follows, closely in the heels of the exposition. So there are so many directions if part of your love is the love of the development of the city, from the Chicago fire in 1871 to the exposition in 93 to the Plan for Chicago, you can just see this incredible project growing in the early history of our city.
Completely agree with all of that. And that is definitely on my mind. I have some other kind of longer term goals that I would like to get into as this project continues to go forward. Right now, as you mentioned, I'm pursuing some grant funding and applying to those. I've been applying since the beginning of the year. And what I'm trying to do with that is do some on-site events with some of the universities around the city and the region to bring academics in for panels, show a shortened cut. So there are two cuts of the documentary. The one up on Amazon is the 48-minute cut, but I have another 20-minute cut that I'm also sending out to film festivals and things like that. So it just got accepted to another film festival based out of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I think, recently. So I'm still waiting on some details on that, but we'll begin promoting that more very soon as well. But what I really want to do is stage these events, have historians, official academic historians, come out and discuss, their perspectives as it relates to the topic and the project, and then also film interviews with them and get them doing basic talking head style reflection on their work and the event, and then cut another version of the documentary that would be proper full length. And I'd say maybe about 90 minutes, I think, would be the goal on that. So about double the time. And I don't think that would be difficult to do. I'm getting more and more content all the time as I keep researching this thing. And also, when people start talking, and they start opening up about their academic relationships to the event or how this event ties into what they've been doing academically, there's just so many great facts and historically relevant pieces of information that, I didn't address in this. I've done this all basically in front of everyone. As I said, my first draft was a Twitter thread that, I just gave away on Twitter. So it was right there for everybody to see, and it's still there.
Which is great that it is, because it triggers interest from a technological standpoint. And because I'm intrigued by your background. I mean, I introduced you as a full spectrum content producer. I don't even know what that means, but I know you are. But your work in music and photography and writing. So part of the expansion of this also has to be from a technological perspective and so that we see things perhaps we have not yet seen on this event.
Right, right. So, you know, I consider myself an archivist and a documentarian trying to preserve what, you know, is left of the event. But I also am very interested in bringing those things forward into today. And the most interesting things to me technologically happening from a media standpoint, from a creative standpoint, and from a content distribution and consumption standpoint is extended reality and mixed reality. And I think that there's a huge opportunity to begin to explore this event within those contexts, whether it is virtual reality or augmented reality. And, you know, that is kind of where I'm headed now. So I've begun doing some pilot experiments to actually make that happen. And, you know, there's a few relationships that I'm developing right now that are looking very good and very interesting. And people are compelled to continue talking with me about that aspect of the project because, you know, in this era of time, being able to bring content directly to people, you know, many of these facilities around the city have been closed and it's been very difficult for people to experience this stuff. But if they are able to go outside into the world and bring this thing back to life in an augmented reality capacity, well, you know, then everybody's safe and they're able to learn and absorb this stuff. In terms of virtual reality, that's super immersive and we can make that deliverable. Go straight into people's homes. And that's super fascinating to me as well, you know, as a person who is, you know, interested in technology and also, you know, creating this thing and looking for ways to expand it and tell more of the story and create, you know, an original narrative based in that environment in the White City.
So when you,
in the Columbian
when you say, Michael, when you talk about augmented reality, virtual reality, I think we all get now because we're all living, our entire life is virtual. But what is augmented reality? How would we experience that?
So the big example that everybody kind of dials into as an augmented reality success story is Pokemon Go, obviously. You know, a few years back when that was released, you would see hordes of people walking around chasing Pokemon everywhere across the country and the world, I think, as well. And, you know, while I don't know that we're going to get hordes of kids and their parents, you know, running around the Columbian Exposition or a recreation of Jackson Park, I do think that there is a great opportunity for, you know, field trips in that sense where, to be honest with you, like this experience can be put anywhere. It doesn't even need to, the kids wouldn't even need to come to Chicago to do this, but we could also do it right in Chicago, right where it was. So it creates a lot of flexibility. And obviously it's something that, you know, that I would love to do because I've spent so much time with this over the last 2.5 years that it's, you know, I'm not going to say it's part of my identity, but it's definitely something that, you know, people identify me with and associate me with.
You know, it's interesting. I just think, and for folks who are listening in and maybe, you know, as I said, haven't really thought about the Columbian Exposition of 1893, or maybe they've heard of it, but haven't looked at it, there is something magical about that experience that when you start sort of doing any kind of work, maybe even just listening to us, you sort of get into it. And because of the phenomenal history that it is to the city, it doesn't take long before you can immerse yourself in wanting to learn as much as possible. I did a reference earlier to The Devil in the White City, and that's because people know that book, but it's the backdrop of it is the 1893 World's Fair. So there's, you know, it's been used in so many different ways. But Michael, for folks who want to follow you, and because obviously there's more to come from you, so what's the best way to track you and your developments as time goes on?
Well, you know, you can connect with me on social media via my website. It's michael-finney.com. And, you know, all my social channels, my primary social channels are linked there. So I have, you know, Facebook pages for me, for the Columbian Exposition Project, Chicago 1893, as I'm calling it. And that exists on Facebook and Twitter. Fundamentally now, I'm going to move it into some other places as I keep moving forward. And it also has links to the documentary, the book, the merchandise, the soundtrack album, and, you know, some of my other projects as well. And that, I would say, is the best way to get in contact with me.
And if we go on to Amazon and put your name in, along with 1893 Chicago's Columbian Exposition, that's the quickest way to get to the book that we've been talking about, and also to view the documentary. Fortunately, with Amazon Prime, you can just click a button and watch it immediately, right?
Yeah, very, very easy to get access to those resources. And, you know, I think it's really great that Amazon gives people like me a platform to deliver this stuff. I think that, you know, to be able to get this directly to people without a lot of barriers has been critical. I mean, I released the documentary last year in September, and, you know, I haven't actually premiered this thing in any venue yet, and I would love to do that. And at some point, I do intend to do that. But as it is right now, you know, it's online and streaming, and people can bring it right into their homes. And it's great to
hear from
people when they do.
And you know what? I think if people also start by going to the Chicago Architectural Foundation, take one of the magnificent architectural boat tours, you know, do a walking tour, there's an early Chicago and a late Chicago, do the earliest Chicago. I mean, those are the kind of things for me 20 plus years ago that got me into the history of the Chicago city I've lived in my whole life, but then triggered the appreciation for it to where pretty soon you just get just so involved in it. You can't learn enough. And guess what? You live here. So you really get to explore and find these things, and in my case, maybe even build up a bit of a collection too, and you as well, you know, to actually have some things that were from that era in our city. It's an amazing thing. So, Michael Finney, I'm glad I found you, and I encourage people to certainly check out the book and the documentary on Amazon, and then we'll keep an eye on you as you develop new projects and post about them, and we'll be able to learn even more in the years go on, because although this event was over 125 years ago, it continues to fascinate in a variety of ways, and it's so important to the history of our city. We should all learn about it. Michael, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on, Paul. I really appreciate being able to come on and talk about the project with you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes, and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.